It's summertime, 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 summertime.
It was August of 1962. Summertime by the Jamies, a Quincy group, was on the national charts. It was a great time to stop and get a frosty root beer at Marshfield's Johnson's Drive-In, or head to the beaches of Plymouth and Duxbury, maybe driving a VW Beetle. President John F. Kennedy was in the White House. His brother Edward was making a first run for the U.S. Senate. And somewhere in Boston, a plan was starting to take shape.
And that plan was putting the pieces in place to pull off what would be the biggest armed robbery cash haul in state history. John Kelly was the reported mastermind behind the scene, scoping out the route, watching state police patrols on the Cape and the South Shore, and planning everything in meticulous detail.
A 6-ounce bottle of Coke was a dime, a gallon of gas, 31 cents. The estimated take from the bank van heist, over $1.5 million. That summer, banks on the Cape had decided to bypass using an armored car, reportedly to save money, and had instead decided to use a van with a couple of guards to bring a large stash of cash to the Federal Reserve Bank in Boston.
And the local cops and the feds were already watching a number of the usual suspects, including one South Shore man, who they suspected of being a player in the drug trade and in a number of armed robberies.
The August 14th armed robbery went off like clockwork. Several fake cops diverted traffic off Route 3, so the crew of crooks would have a clear shot at robbing the van. Bob Fournier remembers the day.
I was riding to the Cape with my mother, I believe. She was taking me down there to Camp Edwards. And when we got down past the Hanover exit and approached the hill, there was a police officer in the middle of Route 3, and he was directing all the traffic down exit 12, and my mother asked him what was going on, and he said something about an accident or something, and that we could simply follow the exit route down to the next exit and get back on Route 3. So we didn't think anything of it at the time, but oddly enough, that police officer, we found out later through the news, happened to be part of the holdup crew that detoured the road in order to rob the car that was on Route 3.
And just like that, the crew of fake cops and real robbers got the van in Plymouth, tied up the guards, grabbed the loot, and took off. One report said they even had a lady for a lookout on an overpass. Their car, one of several to be switched and ditched, was found near the Braintree Split.
A number of law enforcement agencies worked on solving the case, led by U.S. Postal Inspectors. Retired Inspector Fred Ricker says he and several dozen others worked hard to solve the case.
I worked on it for 5 years, from August of 62 till the federal statutes expired in August of 67. And then I worked on it for another 6 months or so because we were investigating under the state. The state ran for 10 years.
Three suspects, including John Kelly of Watertown, Thomas Richards of Weymouth, and Patricia D'Aferio of Rosendale, were eventually indicted and brought to trial. Richards disappeared the day the trial started. He was never seen again. Ricker says even though some evidence was found, the laws at that time made it tough to prosecute the suspects.
Well, they were no smarter than anyone else. They were criminals. It was frustrating because of the we operated within the scope of the law. And there was a lot of things that we'd like to do, but we couldn't do because we were bound by the law.
Kelly and D'Aferio were defended by a team that included F. Lee Bailey. And they got off. Ricker says Kelly was probably involved in the heist and a number of other jobs, too.
Well, he was a manipulator, and he was a sly fox. And he testified against some pretty bad people and put a lot of people in jail.
Kelly eventually testified against a major crime boss and went into the witness protection program. After a time, his wife had him declared dead. The money, over $1.5 million, was never officially found, according to Ricker.
Money was unmarked bills, and there was no way of tracing it. They didn't keep serial numbers. We recovered money, but we couldn't attribute it to the Plymouth mail robbery.
Some 20 years later, that South Shore man or player we told you about, he drops dead in his home. The feds moved in with a search warrant a couple of days later, and foreman has told them there are three hidden safes in the house, and they're worth taking a look at. They find a few items, like drug paraphernalia, stun gun, bulletproof vest, and a few other items, but no big cash haul and no hidden safes.
It might seem like end of the story, but it's not. Flash forward again, another 20-plus years later, almost to the anniversary of the man's death. A young couple on a side street in one of the South Shore's tonier towns begins a home renovation project, starting in the kitchen. As the vintage 1960s drop-in stove is torn out, there is a loud thud. That thud was a gun that fell from underneath a fake panel under the stove. And it wasn't the only one. Ripping the panel out showcased several more older guns hanging from hooks under the stove. When they went in deeper, what they found was surprising. Several gun silencers, a bulletproof vest, a 1960s-style Dinell wig, handcuffs, finger cuffs, and a police badge from a Metro West department. Was this man the missing link to the Great Plymouth Mail robbery? Dead men do take some of their secrets to the grave, but this guy didn't take all of them. The money has never been found, but those three safes have never been found either. And the trace on the guns could tie them to the crime. But the couple who own the home say they're still not done with remodeling, and they plan on working on the home for a long time. I'm Christine James for WATD News.